loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, President Trump signed a new executive order yesterday denying migrants the right to ask for asylum when they're caught crossing the border without a visa. Immigrant rights organizations say the new executive order targets Central Americans almost exclusively. Meanwhile, a federal appeals court yesterday blocked the Trump administration from ending DACA, or deferred action for childhood arrivals. Next, a federal judge late last night blocked construction of the controversial Keystone XL pipeline, saying that the Trump administration had, quote, simply disregarded, unquote, the effect that the pipeline will have on climate change. The president said today that he'll take the issue to the Supreme Court. Then Utah, Nebraska, and Idaho, three Republican-dominated states, all voted to expand Medicaid in midterm election ballot measures. What will this mean for the residents in those states, and what will it mean for the fight for the right to health care across the country? And then four inmates in Tennessee are on death row and are suing the state to let them choose to be killed by firing squad rather than by the electric chair or lethal injection. Both methods have had many legal challenges, and the last lethal injection execution in Tennessee, which took place on August 9th, took more than 20 minutes to complete. And finally, it's Friday, so we'll look at the week's worst, funniest, and most misleading headlines. That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear. Now we turn to the White House and a new executive order. President Trump signed a new executive order yesterday denying migrants the right to ask for asylum when they're caught crossing the border without a visa. Immigrant rights organizations say the new executive order targets Central Americans almost exclusively. Meanwhile, a federal appeals court yesterday blocked the Trump administration from ending DACA, or deferred action for childhood arrivals. We're joined from New York by Juan Carlos Ruiz. He's the co-founder of New Sanctuary Coalition. Juan Carlos, welcome back.
Thank you. Thank you, John. It's good to be here.
Well, we're glad to have you. Juan Carlos, there's been this rumor, this buzz here in Washington over the last 3 or 4 weeks that this executive order was coming. And now the elections are over and it has come. What do you think in the near term the effect is going to be? The law is very clear that you're allowed to enter the states to request asylum. Now this says that you're not allowed to enter the states to request asylum. What next?
Yeah, you know, I was reading, and it does clearly say that between points of entry, and the protocol has been so far, as you know, John, is that if you come in asking for asylum, you hand yourself over to the Border Patrol.
That's right.
And the Border Patrol has to, you know, grant that request after a interview, you know, credible fear interview. And then we know that that's not easy. We know that given the political climate nowadays, that door keeps getting shut and it's not even ajar anymore. And that there are rather few people that get any kind of fair hearing, any asylum, but given this climate. But this seems to be kind of over the top, and this really, you know, signals how the administration has gone wrong in terms of not really, you know, this policy of welcoming those who are seeking refuge is just, you know, non-existent anymore. And this is kind of the last nail on the coffin for that. So we do need, you know, international law. We need to really, you know, I mean, it has to come into play because we have people, this flow of humanity coming to our shores seeking, you know, some asylum because they are getting displaced and they are getting killed by conditions, by violent conditions that we as a country have been, you know, complicit. So I think we need to denounce that, and we need to really, you know, really push back against these policies that, you know, make of our country, you know, a mockery in terms. I mean, here in New York, we have the Statue of Liberty. I mean, that doesn't have any meaning whatsoever right now.
No, it actually doesn't, does it?
No, not at all. given our political climate, given our policies, the way they are being enacted, more and more, you know, at the beginning of the year, I thought that we had the door for people to come in and enjoy the freedoms of our democracy. And right now, I am questioning that democratic, opportunity given to not just the citizens of this country, but anybody who is seeking, to live that freedom in our land.
It seems to me that just based on past experience, and when I say past, I mean over the last 2 years, that this is going to end up in the courts. And the federal courts, at least at the district level, have been relatively quick at striking down most of what the president has wanted to do on the issue of asylum. Do you see that as the next step going into the federal courts again?
Yeah, I do hope that this is halt, nip at the bud, because it does, it does present a rather horrible picture in terms of who we are as a country, who do not want to listen, do not want to have our doors open to those who are seeking, justifiably so, help. We are known, we have been known for being a country of immigrants, and I think we cannot turn away from our past. Our diversity, multiracial history, attest to the fact that immigrants in our midst, people seeking refuge, are part and parcel of our rich cultural history. I think we cannot deny that from our past, and I think it is also our future as a country that basically proclaims freedom and liberty for all. What does that mean when we close our borders? Many people keep saying to me, is that a wall that they are building? Is it to keep people out or to keep us in? Is it being a jail for us more like anything else now that there is not this fluidity in terms of going back and forth? Many of my immigrant friends basically, because the over-militarized wall that already exists, feel really very much threatened. And they are mostly, green card holders and citizens, but they are still being targeted because of that. These policies are, basically determined by racial lines. So, and it is an attack. It is an affront against the Central American people, which in 2009, this government had their hands in terms of, being complicit with the coup that happened there, after ousting Zelaya, the president, the Democratic president elected in Honduras. That whole, that incident destabilized the whole region, what is called the Northern Triangle, which is El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras. And we have seen it. We have seen the consequences of our meddling politically, economically. And now, with this caravan and with the constant bleeding of immigrants into our country, it is a direct consequence of our foreign policy. And we need to, we need to really reflect on that. And, change. I think this blue wave in these midterm elections, it's very telling in terms of, locally we need to do something. But then how do we translate this local kind of take back the ballot power into the national? So the next coming days, I think months, are going to be really telling in terms if, we are going to be able to propose something that is, that will benefit our society, here as a nation, and also, on the broader angle perspective, what kind of a nation are we, for our neighbors, for others.
We have about a minute and a half left. I wanted to mention to you a conversation I had last week with a high-ranking Trump campaign official who told me that Stephen Miller, the much vilified extreme right-wing official from Santa Monica, California, is single-handedly writing U.S. immigration policy right now, that no one else in the administration has influence on immigration policy other than Stephen Miller. What do you make of that? Do you think things are going to get worse than what we've already seen?
I do believe that we are, yes, in a collusion course. I do believe that the administration right now, it's following some agenda of genocide. And we can see this clearly being played out against the Central Americans that are being vilified and demonized. You know, when that happens, you know, the justice and the cry for freedom is far, far from away from us. And it does something to our common humanity in terms of belittling us and making us who we do not want to be.
It tears the country apart, frankly, and it makes us weaker. We're going to have to leave it there. We were joined from New York by Juan Carlos Ruiz, co-founder of New Sanctuary Coalition. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll come right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou in studio with my co-host Brian Becker. A federal judge late last night blocked construction of the controversial Keystone XL pipeline, saying that the Trump administration had, quote, simply disregarded, unquote, the effect that the pipeline will have on climate change. But the president said today that he will take the issue to the Supreme Court. We're joined from Tucson, Arizona by Andrea Carmen. She's the executive director of the International Indian Treaty Council. Welcome to the show, Andrea.
Thank you very much, and thank you for inviting me.
Oh, it's our pleasure. And I want to start, actually, by getting your reaction to Donald Trump's reaction. On CNN this morning, the president said that his loss on this issue was a great thing because it now allows him to appeal the issue to the Supreme Court. Do you think that it's a great thing? Do you think this is good for environmentalists, or do you think that this is a dangerous development that's going to allow the Supreme Court to come down on the side of Donald Trump and the climate change deniers?
Well, first of all, as an American Indian indigenous person, I'm a member of the Yaqui Nation here in southern Arizona, and our ancestral territory is also in northern Mexico. We're one of those tribes divided by this U.S. border, not migrants, but original peoples that now have a border running through our territory. But of course, this is positive news for indigenous rights as well as for those that are working diligently to defend the environment and combat climate change. We don't have a lot of faith in the decisions of the Supreme Court, especially stacked as it is right now. But the rule of law checking this president is always a positive thing, not just for us, but I think for everybody, that he can't just do and say whatever he wants, even though that's what he tries to get away with. We actually took the executive orders and presidential memorandum that he issued, I think, 2 days after he took power. Back, his administration was seated back in January of 2017 to the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights as violating not just the UN Declaration on Rights of Indigenous Peoples, but the newly adopted what's called the American Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples that upholds treaty rights, free, prior, informed consent, right of Indigenous peoples to the health of their environments, and of course lands, territories, and waters. So all of those were violated by his executive orders that called to streamline and expedite the development of the Dakota Access Pipeline, which everyone had heard about by then, but also the Keystone XL Pipeline that the previous President Obama, had blocked because of its potential threats to the environment. So, you know, overriding not just the legal process by which the U.S. government calls on corporations and the government itself to abide by certain procedures and hearings and reviews of the environmental impact, but also, of course, indigenous rights. And if the president plans to take this issue to the U.S. Supreme Court, I invite him to remind them that the U.S. Constitution says that treaties are the supreme law of the land. And this process that the XL pipeline is part of violates treaties not only in the United States, but also the treaties, the 11 historic treaties in Canada as well, because we need to remember where this dirty oil comes from in the first place.
That is such an important issue that nobody is talking about. Treaties that are ratified by the United States Senate are the law of the land, period. So the issue really has been decided already. So help walk me through this thing. So last year we had direct action protesting the pipeline. So many people went to Standing Rock and they held their ground, and the Obama administration at the very end of the administration decided to do the right thing. The Trump administration ended up reversing that decision. So now what?
Well, now what is what we're seeing now is going to different state courts. I know that Standing Rock is still in the process of pushing through the review that was called for by the previous administration before the pipelines could continue. And I think we just need to continue to stand our ground. You know, we're not confident that the U.S. Supreme Court will choose to recall. I hope, though, that the lawyers on the side of stopping the pipeline, you know, will also include treaty rights, will include the rights of indigenous peoples that have been agreed to by the United States. You know, and of course, the U.S. voted against the U.N. Declaration on Rights of Indigenous Peoples back in 2007 when it was adopted, one of just four countries in the whole world. But they have reversed their position. So supposedly, they've made an additional commitment to rights of indigenous peoples, including free, prior, informed consent, which, of course, you know, when you're looking at the treaties that the U.S. government ratified through the Senate with the Ocheté Sakoan, with the Lakota, Dakota, and Nakota tribal nations, it also calls, those treaties also call for consent before incursion of outsiders onto the land recognized by the treaties. And these are some of the issues that we took to the United Nations when we were supporting Standing Rock and their struggle against the DAPL pipeline, is to recall that this is international law, because that's the way we consider the treaty relationship between the settler governments like Canada and the United States and the original nations. As they like to say, the indigenous peoples in Canada, that treaties don't make nations, but only nations can make treaties. And that's international treaty law. So these are nation-to-nation agreements. They're both federal, based on the Constitution, right, and international law, and need to be upheld. In the whole struggle against the Dakota Access Pipeline, there was only one U.S. politician that I saw on the news, on the TV, I think it was CNN, Raul Grijalva, who's a congressman from here in Tucson, actually went on and said, this is a treaty issue. And he's the only one that I even heard ever say that. And so hopefully, like I said, if this does go to the Supreme Court, I hope that the attorneys for the environmentalists and for the tribes remember to raise the issue of the U.S. Constitution, which the Supreme Court is supposed to uphold, says that treaties are the supreme law of the land. And this pipeline violates treaties, and adopted, again, just to recall the alliances that have built up around this issue between the treaty nations in Canada and the treaty nations in the United States. We ratified again at our treaty conference, which was actually in Bear Butte, South Dakota, in June. Our 44th anniversary treaty conference was held there, and we ratified the what was called the Mother Earth Accord that was signed in 2012 between the treaty nations in Canada and the treaty nations in what is now the U.S., to maintain solidarity between each other in stopping the Keystone XL pipeline. So this has been a long struggle for, you know, Indigenous peoples, for Indian treaty nations, and evidently it's going to continue. But, hey, let's give ourselves the recognition of the victory that happened last night. Hey,
give yourself a little bit of time to celebrate.
Give ourselves, because this is about stopping climate change, too. It affects every single one of us, and especially our children and grandchildren, nieces and nephews. You know, this is a victory on the side of life and rights. So, you know, let's celebrate it, see what happens next, and take that struggle on when it comes.
We have 90 seconds left. I wanted to ask if you're getting any indication, receiving any indication from the Native community as to what they expect as this unfolds. Of course, it is going to be appealed to the Supreme Court. The president essentially came out and said that today. What do you think the court looks like now with two Trump appointments sitting up there?
Well, we all recognize that it looks pretty bad, not just for Indigenous rights, because it's, you know, I think somebody did a study even, you know, with past Supreme Courts, and I think we were about 80% losing every issue we ever took to the Supreme Court, you know, where development was up against protection of sacred sites, treaty rights, land rights, and right to, you know, food sovereignty, our treaty right to food. You know, it hasn't been a good history for American Indians of the Supreme Court, really. Now, I think everyone agrees it's worse. And not only is it worse because you have, you know, the right-wing judges that are there, but you have one that just got placed there who has already made a lot of statements and legal history in not wanting to curtail the powers of the U.S. president. And that bodes not well for this issue, but a lot of other ones.
That was the voice of Andrea Carmen, who joined us from Tucson, Arizona. Andrea is the executive director of the International Indian Treaty Council. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be back after a short break.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. Utah, Nebraska, and Idaho, three Republican-dominated states, all voted to expand Medicaid in midterm election ballot measures. What will this mean for residents in those states, and what will it mean for the fight for the rights to health care across this country? We are joined in studio by Leo Cuello. Leo is an attorney, and he is the director of health policy for the National Health Law Program. Leo, welcome back.
Thanks so much for having me.
We talked to you just in the weeks running up to last Tuesday's ballot. The issue of Medicaid expansion was on the ballot before the voters in referendum in four states. You were nervous.
I felt pretty good about, you know, things were going to go well in a lot of them. I didn't know if we were going to run the table. So,
and what happened?
And so what happened was really a great outcome. We got, remembering that we already won a ballot initiative in Maine for Medicaid expansion there last year, and we won it in three new states, Utah, Idaho, and Nebraska, which were the three new states. And the only state that didn't win was Montana, which is actually a horse of a totally different color, which we can talk about how and why that is. But in Utah, Idaho, and Nebraska, three challenging red states, we won Medicaid expansion, and the average margin of victory across the states was about 12 points. So these were not nail biters that ended up being, you know, a Florida type of 50.5 to 49.5 type of win. And that translates into 325,000 people right there, boom, in one shot, who are going to now be able to get health insurance.
So these were states, Utah, Nebraska, Idaho, where Republican candidates actually did well, but the Republican effort to sabotage, destroy the Affordable Care Act, and in particular, the expansion of Medicaid such that people who made considerably more but still not making that much money could access Medicaid. That's the story there.
Yeah, I mean, I think the Republican Party hopefully will finally learn the lesson that healthcare is just not a partisan issue for people. You know, Republicans and Democrats alike think people should have access to affordable healthcare. And that's true for a majority of Democrats, and it's true for a majority of Republicans. And they support, you know, all of the various provisions of the Affordable Care Act, whether that's the Medicaid expansion or pre-existing conditions or whatever pre-existing condition prevention. So, you know, we need to really use this frame that this is a, you know, Medicaid expansion, healthcare. It's not a partisan issue. It wins in all of these places. And hopefully the Republicans will learn their lesson and, you know, focus on other things, not trying to take away people's health care.
So what did the referendum actually say, and how does it impact the access of Medicaid for people in those states?
So all of these states are ballot initiative statute states, which means you can actually start a law through the ballot process. And this is not something that's available in every state. So these are particular states that did it because that option was there. So these really do create the similar effect of a legislature passing a law.
It's the law of the land for that state now.
Exactly, exactly. So that's really significant. And if we look at the big picture scoreboard, right, we had 34 states that either had Medicaid expansion or were in process for Medicaid expansion. So with Maine and these three states, that number is going to jump to 38, which leaves only 38 plus DC. So that leaves only 13 states where there isn't something. And in those states, about half of them have such a similar process available, this ballot-initiated statute process, meaning of those 13, about half of them we could see a similar thing happen in the coming years because those in those states, people are going to realize, oh, wait, we can do this too.
We've discussed this before, but just let's pretend that someone's tuning in for the first time. How does Medicaid expansion not only benefit the individuals in those states, how does it benefit the states? What's the equation here between federal subsidies, federal support, and what the state actually has to do?
Right. So the benefits to the state are huge. Of course, individuals get health insurance, and that's their quality of life, and people actually live longer, right? It also means that uncompensated care in the state spending goes down because uninsured people are less often showing up at an emergency room. That helps the whole state infrastructure. Rural hospitals are less likely to close. It also is very generously federally funded. In perpetuity, at least 90% of the funding comes from the federal government. So the states are solving this huge insurance crisis problem with 90% of the money being drawn from the federal government. That's federal funding that flows into the state, which increases state revenues. It increases the state's economy, and it actually creates jobs in the state. So the multiplier positive effects of this expansion for these states are really huge and significant.
Leo Cuello is our guest. Leo is an attorney and the director of health policy for the National Health Law Program here in Washington, D.C. He's talking to us in studio. Leo, what's the possible argument that would be offered against Medicaid expansion or is offered by its opponents?
So the most typical argument offered against it is a cost-based argument, which is a really, really narrow vision, right? It's like saying, I'm against college because it costs money to go to college, right? Yes, that's true if you look in a really narrow way at the question, but what you're doing, right, by spending money on college is increasing your life's potential in so many different ways. That's sort of the same thing that's going on. The state will have to pay 10% of the cost of health insurance for these individuals. However, as we said, this is solving so many problems for the states because, for example, some of these individuals, if they don't get insurance, they continue to be uninsured, they have mental health breakdown, let's say. That actually in many places gets funded through state and county funds, where they have to take care of those individuals, right?
They're indigent, they're poor, they go to the emergency room, they've had a mental breakdown, the municipal hospital takes care of them, the city, the taxpayers pay that bill.
Exactly. So first of all, that money that they're spending to provide Medicaid insurance to people is actually money that they're already spending in all these other ways. But then you also get a much more productive workforce, right? In some of these states, you're talking about 400,000 people who now have health insurance. Some of these people have chronic illnesses that, when properly managed, you suddenly have somebody who is, you know, a fully and effective worker in your state's economy, and that's really positive. So the argument against it is just conceived of in such a narrow way that it doesn't really get at why the idea works so well. And it's been shown now in all the states that have done it.
Leo Cuello is our guest. Leo, one of the signature agenda items of the Republican Party after Trump took office January 20th, 2017, was to repeal and replace Affordable Care Act. They failed at that. Too many contradictions. Too many of their own constituents had pre-existing conditions or this, that, or the other thing held them up. Now with the Democrats controlling the House, is that effort now finished?
It's pretty finished for the next 2 years. So, I mean, I think we should step back about that election and let's talk about the positives and negatives. Positive number one, the legislative agenda for the Trump administration is pretty dead for the next 2 years. What does that mean? That means ACA repeal is very unlikely to happen. That means block grants in the Medicaid program, which are a massive defunding to the program, is unlikely to happen. Other bad things they want to do to Medicaid and Medicare are unlikely to happen. The second positive we have from that election is governorships and state legislatures that flipped to legislatures and governors that are pro-Medicaid, pro-healthcare, in many cases Democrats. That is going to solve a lot of problems in states like Kansas, Maine, Wisconsin, Michigan, that we're all having bad healthcare fights. Those are fights, many of them are just going to go away. We have, of course, these ballot initiatives, which are huge positives. The negatives that are hanging out there, because the Democrats didn't take the Senate, you have the risk of Supreme Court confirmations where you could get somebody who is willing to entertain frivolous lawsuits to try and take out healthcare programs. So that's a negative that did not get resolved. And so what that leaves us with is our baseline negative, which is, as great as the election was, that's the legislature. It doesn't change that the administration in office right now seems to be hell-bent on taking healthcare away from people. They're doing it in umpteen different ways. There are lawsuits being filed to try and stop them. We have filed some of them. Others have filed others. And that fight is going to continue for the next 2 years. They don't have a legislative agenda anymore. So the concern is that now the president will even further exceed his authority to try and do things to harm healthcare.
Here we are today, Judge Ginsburg on a Supreme Court fell. She has three broken ribs. You know, it conjures up the idea that she or others on the Supreme Court, the sitting Supreme Court, may at some point retire or not be there. That gives Donald Trump room for a third or a fourth or a fifth Supreme Court justice. He's already stacked the federal judiciary in the first 2 years of his administration. How important are the courts in this process?
The courts are just so important. You can't, there's just no way to even overstate this. The decisions that we saw with respect to the Affordable Care Act were very important Supreme Court decisions that, you know, the law survived kind of by the skin of its teeth, but they go to a much broader point, which is The premise of these cases. These were cases about, can the federal government actually step in and solve a national problem? We have a national problem where 50 million people don't have health insurance, and President Obama tries to pass a law to address that using the congressional authority that is vested in the Constitution to do that, right? It's the Congress who passed the law, of course, not President Obama. He signed it. And this Supreme Court was a cusp away from saying, no, Congress doesn't have the power to step in and solve these kinds of national level problems. And, you know, they invent a whole series of constitutional arguments as to why, right? One of them is states' rights, right? Which the whole reason we have a federal government is there are some problems that are not state-to-state problems, but there are huge national problems happening everywhere, and you need a national system to address the problem. That's why we have Medicare, a national problem. program. That's why we have Social Security, a national program.
All right, we're going to leave it right there. We were joined here in studio by Leo Cuello. Leo is an attorney. He is the director of health policy for the National Health Law Program. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a short break, we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. Four inmates in Tennessee are on death row and are suing the state of Tennessee to let them choose to be killed via firing squad rather than the electric chair or lethal injection. Both methods have had many legal challenges, and the last lethal injection execution in Tennessee, which took place on August 9th, took more than 20 minutes to complete. That means to kill the individual. We're joined in studio by Deborah Golden. Deborah is an attorney with Human Rights Defense Center and a national expert in prisoner human rights litigation. Welcome.
Welcome. Happy to be here.
Thank you. I mean, it's when we discussed this at our editorial meeting a couple of days ago, I have to say some people were astonished that here you have inmates on death row suing in order to have a firing squad put them to death. The whole thing seems so macabre, but the broader audience that's going to be listening to this show here in Washington and around the country understand, why would they do that?
What these men are saying in their lawsuit is that the means that Tennessee currently uses for execution, either a particular three-drug protocol or the electric chair, both have the potential to cause extensive pain and suffering, and that one of the methods they suggest as a ready alternative if they have to be put to death is a firing squad, which, according to their experts, is a faster and more humane way to put somebody to death. But the blood pressure instantly drops, the person is unconscious and does not feel pain.
Deborah, 30 states in the United States have the death penalty. 20 states have death penalty bans. I think those are the numbers. If I'm wrong, correct me.
I believe that's correct.
There are thousands of people waiting to be executed on death row in the United States. Here we're having a debate about the method of execution, but let's talk about the problem of the death penalty. Of course, many, many progressive organizations, human rights organizations, certainly people in Europe and around the world are insisting that the U.S. bring this penalty to an end. Talk about the problem with the death penalty writ large.
The death penalty is riddled with discrimination. We know that it discriminates against people of color. It discriminates against poor people. We have seen in recent years many, many people be exonerated with advancements in DNA. But for those advancements in science, they would not have been exonerated. So we know that the death penalty procedures are not foolproof. We know that there are innocent people put to death. We know innocent people probably have been put to death in this country. And as you say, it makes the United States an outlier among our peers. Nobody else puts people to death for crimes. No other state takes the position that it has the right to kill its own citizens.
Deborah, I'm looking at an article from 21 years ago. It's another alternative means of executing people, the electric chair, at one time the favored method. Condemned man's mask bursts into flames during execution. That's the headline. It's about the execution of a Cuban who came here during the Mariel boat lift. His name was Pedro Medina. He was 39 years old when he was executed. He insisted that he was innocent. Matter of fact, his last words before his mask burst into flames was, "I am still innocent." The governor, Lawton Chiles of Florida, and the attorney general seemed to be very cavalier about the fact that his mask that he was wearing actually burst into flames. Mr. Chiles, the governor, said, quote, he was told by the attending doctor that, quote, the burns were no different than you'd see at any execution. And in his opinion, he felt no pain. He also said, we've had an occasion to smoke before, but the question is really, is this something that is torturous or painful? People who wish to commit murder, this is the attorney general, they better not do it in the state of Florida because we have a problem with our electric chair. I mean, it's amazing language when you read back 21 years ago how government officials talked about the death penalty with such cavalier aplomb, not caring at all whether it was torture or not. A lot's happened in the last 21 years, and yet a lot still stays the same.
I think that's true. I think one of the things that we see in the history of the death penalty in this country is that there has been a movement of the government to try and make it appear more humane by giving people paralytic agents, by giving them other drugs which mask their reaction. But what the story you just read and what the gentlemen in Tennessee are saying is that, in fact, that keeps them from reacting to the incredible pain and horror that they are experiencing.
I read, or I didn't read, I was listening to another radio show where the people who were advocating for the end of the death penalty were also explaining what it means to be put to death by lethal injection, that in some instances it's the same, in a way, as being burned at the stake, something from medieval times or earlier times of antiquity. Is that true?
That is true, and that's what these gentlemen and their experts have laid out in their lawsuit, which spans over 200 pages of testimony and evidence. They explain that the first drug is an agent that will paralyze somebody, but actually causes an acidic reaction so that lungs fill with fluid from the inside. A person cannot physically react, but feels the sensation as they are drowning in their own bodily fluid. On top of that, they are then given a shot of another chemical that causes them to feel like they are on fire from the inside out, and again, cannot react until such time as they finally pass away. It's incredibly painful, according to the doctors and chemists who have studied what these medicines do.
Some of the men who filed this lawsuit demanding that they be executed by firing squad rather than the electric chair or lethal injection, they've been on death row now for almost, at least one of them, almost 30 years. How unusual is that?
That's not unusual. People are on death row for decades as they pursue their appeals and continue to wait. Of course, one of the delays that some states are finding is that the companies that produce these medicines and chemicals, which do have other medicinal uses, these companies aren't willing to sell to states so that they can execute someone. They feel that as medical providers, taking a life is against what they stand for and will not be a part of it.
So some of the states are delaying executions because they can't get the necessary drugs.
Right. And that's part of these men's complaint to the courts in Tennessee, saying also that because of the inability to purchase some of these drugs on the open market and legally, that they are obtained in a gray market where nobody knows exactly what the chemicals are or what's being done to them.
It seems surreal, doesn't it, 2018?
It does. It's hard to believe that this is where we are.
So you have states that have the death penalty, and again, 20 states have banned it. So depending on whether you kill somebody or do some heinous crime or are convicted of it, whether you're guilty or not, you won't be put to death in some parts of America, but in other parts of America, you can not only be put to death, but be sort of burned at the stake chemically.
Chemically or in the electric chair where people catch fire. This is not a scientific way of treating someone. This is just hooking up some electrodes and hoping it's enough to stop their heart.
Advocates of the death penalty will say, okay, these guys are really bad criminals. They did horrible things. If they suffer a little bit at the end, I don't care. In other words, the sense of vengefulness or vengeance becomes a dominant emotion. What do you say to those people?
I say that the question of the death penalty is not what the individual defendant deserves, but what we as a society take on the right to do ourselves and what it does to us as a country to say that we have the right to kill our own citizens.
Is it a deterrent to crime?
No. All the studies that look at punishments that are deterrents to crime show that those deterrents must be both certain and swift, and the death penalty is neither. As you said, whether or not you're subject to the death penalty depends on what state you're in. It may depend on what county you're in. It certainly depends on how much money you have to hire a defense. And so there's nothing certain about that penalty, and there's nothing swift about it either with people on death row for years and years and years. Punishments that deter people have to be the kind of punishment that can be implemented immediately and certainly.
Are there any rich people on death row?
I am not aware of any. I could be wrong, but I am not aware of any.
It would be the exception.
It would certainly be the exception.
Because if you have a good lawyer, you're probably not going to get the death penalty.
That is true.
Yeah. So who is on death row? We have 1 minute left.
People who are poor, people of color, people with severe mental illness, the people that society tries to throw away anyway have been put on death row so that the government can kill them.
And final question, is the United States government or governments executing people who have severe mental illness or others very severe mental disabilities?
They are. Although the Supreme Court has said that that is not something that should happen, states continually fight for the right to do so as they say somebody isn't quite sick enough or faking it or doesn't meet some particular minuscule criteria when everybody knows that this person is very mentally ill or cognitively disabled.
That's the voice of Deborah Golden. She joined us here in studio. Deborah is an attorney with the Human Rights Defense Center. She is a national expert in prisoner human rights litigation. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a short break, we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou in studio with my co-host Brian Becker. It's Friday, so we'll look at the week's worst, funniest, and most misleading headlines. Joining us from the San Francisco Bay Area is Steve Pat. He's an independent journalist whose critiques of the mainstream media have been a feature of his blog, Left Eye on the News. Steve tweets at Left Eye Blog, LeftEyeBlog. And if you go there, you can catch up on all the headlines that we couldn't get to today. And we're also joined in studio by Sputnik News analysts and producers, Nicole Russell and Walter Smolarek. Welcome back, everybody.
Thanks so much.
Hi, everybody.
Good to be here.
We always talk before we go on the air about the headlines that we like the most. And boy, there are just so many of them this time. What do you think, Steve? Where would you like to start?
Well, since the election was a few days ago, I really wanted to start with an election-related headline. And this is interesting. It's from the Washington Post. And the headline is completely accurate. It says, ex-Green Party candidate earns more votes than difference between Sinema and McSally. That's the Senate race in Arizona. But what's wrong with this headline is, why is it even a headline? Why is this an article? And the whole concept that we should consider how many votes the Green Party candidate got and pretend that all those votes would have gone to the Democrat if only the Green Party didn't exist or didn't run the election. I mean, it's just a totally false concept that is offensive to those of us who don't support Democrats or Republicans and do support parties like the Green Party or socialist parties and so on. Or the Libertarian Party. So just the fact that this article is really offensive.
Oh, totally agree. You know, this is the problem with this corrupt duopoly that we have, where you're not a good American if you don't vote for one of the two big parties. And, you know, Gary Johnson, the Libertarian candidate for president, always says that voting for the lesser of two evils is still evil. So don't do it.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great point. This kind of arrogance of these votes belong to one of the two parties, right, is just, it's really, really incredibly, it's arrogant. That's the only word to use
for
this.
You can either vote for the Republican Party or you can vote for the other Republican Party.
Yeah, and it's been so thoroughly debunked by political scientists, this idea that, if the Greens weren't, you know, all of the Green voters would just vote for Democrats otherwise, mm-hmm. or the Libertarian voters would just vote for Republicans otherwise. Like, that's not true. Like, the decision people are making is between not voting or voting for a third party, right?
Which you think would be obvious because our voter turnout is so low anyway. These are the people who, like, decided there was one person that they wouldn't mind casting their vote for, right? Like,
that's a good point.
It's already incredibly low.
Right. And to emphasize Walter's point, this is very ironic because it turns out that the Green Party candidate dropped out of the voting a week in advance of the election and threw her support to the Democrat. And despite that fact, 35,000 people still voted for her because they, even if she dropped out, they weren't going to vote for the Democrat or the Republican. And if she hadn't been in the election at all, they probably, as Walter just said, wouldn't have voted at all. So it's actually quite ironic.
Yeah, I think that really proves the point.
What do we have next, Steve?
Well, since we're on electoral politics, we'll go to the New York governor. This is not really election related.
My favorite person, Andrew Cuomo.
Said no one.
The first one is just silly. New York's governor jokes he'll change his name to Amazon Cuomo to win the HQ2 bid. That's the second headquarters for Amazon. And it reveals just how desperate states are to land Amazon's second headquarters.
Oh, God.
And the related one, which comes from the New York Daily News, Cuomo ready to rename a Long Island city creek, the Amazon River, to woo Amazon into opening its second headquarters in New York City.
And if our listeners don't know anything about Long Island City, it's just a part of Queens that's really heavily industrialized and run down and dirty. And if there's a creek there, I didn't realize there was a creek. I thought it was just the East River. But if there's a creek, it's one of those ones that, you know, you shouldn't have an open flame near.
It'll burn just like burning. Lake Erie. Yeah.
That's right.
This is, I mean, it's pretty funny, but it's also pretty disgusting. I mean, this is really Amazon Cuomo. It's so desperate and like so gross.
Actually, on a more serious note, both of these headlines are a little misleading because we all know that the real way they're trying to lure Amazon is through millions of dollars of tax breaks.
That's what it comes down to.
Yeah, that's true.
Both of these articles kind of distract from that and, you know, make you forget about what the real deal's going on in not only New York, but city after city.
Ha ha ha. He says funny stuff, but no, he's actually selling you out like while your back is turned.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, I know this is kind of a non sequitur, but his brother, Chris Cuomo on CNN. He's one of the big stars of CNN. I actually stopped watching it. I'll change the channel when Chris Cuomo's on because he had a National Geographic scientist on one time. And at the end of the interview, he said, Dr. So-and-so, one final question. He says, Sharknado, is it possible? And I said, all right, I'm done. I'm done.
I didn't realize
Cuomo
that they
family.
Were related.
Oh, they're brothers.
Oh, interesting. Huh?
Yeah, they're brothers.
So,
I've had enough.
Is it possible?
No.
I don't know. Let's go back to the election and also to Russiagate at the same time. And the first two headlines I'm going to read were courtesy of a tweet from Max, your frequent guest, Max Blumenthal. And they contrast between what was and what is. And they're both headlines from the New York Times. The first one's from July, and it reads, "Warning lights are blinking red. Top intelligence officer says of Russian attacks." Attacks on the cyber attacks on the election, not physical war attacks.
Oh man, yeah. So we must have had cyber attacks this week, right, Steve?
Yeah. So that again, that was back in July, and of course, it wasn't just the Times. That was the line throughout the media. Now, the second headline comes from the same Times again. This is November 1st. Mystery of the midterm elections. Where are the Russians? So the fact of the matter is that all these dire warnings about all the Russians are going to take over the elections and influence all the Americans, it was all nonsense. And now that the elections have happened, they can finally admit it.
But it's just like those cunning Russians to cover their tracks so effectively. It's a mystery. Where did they go?
But then we come to the after the elections is the Washington Post. And it's kind of the capper of the whole thing. Forget the Russians. On this election day, it's Americans peddling disinformation and hate speech.
And they've just discovered that.
Yeah. This is new. We've never done this before, ever.
Oh, we just learned it from the Russians. We never would have, you know, done this beforehand. It's just bizarre. Actually, the ironic thing about this article is the article talks about, it's mostly about the caravan. And it talks about the demonstrably false allegations that billionaire George Soros is funding a violent, quote, invasion of the United States. So who was it who was pushing that story? It was Donald Trump. It wasn't just random Americans or Russians or anybody else. It was Trump. And who was, quote unquote, amplifying this story? It was the media. It was, you know, CNN and the Washington Post and everybody else, you know, amplifying the story, although sometimes pointing out that Trump was just not speaking nonsense, but still, you know, it's just crazy.
The media that depended on Trump coming up to the 2016 election to, you know, be able to make money and That now depends on exactly, and now depends on Trump to boost their ratings by trashing him every day.
Mm-hmm.
Not that I disagree with trashing him, but that's definitely what they kind of is their bread and butter at this point.
Actually, there was an instructive bit in this article, which I want to pass on. There was a line in the article. Again, this is from the Washington Post. It said I'm going to read this carefully. Accounts controlled by Russians probably helped amplify such misleading narratives, experts say. Now, but the advantage of these days of reading the news online is that they actually have links. So curious me, I clicked on the thing that said accounts controlled by Russians, and it led me to another article. And in that article, it didn't talk about accounts controlled by Russians at all. It talked about, quote, accounts known to echo Kremlin propaganda. Well, you know what that is. That's people who say that, for example, there was a coup in Ukraine and not a democratic revolution, or people who say it remind people that there was a plebiscite in the Crimea, or people who remind people that there are actually terrorists in Syria who are being fought by the Russian, you know, Air Force largely in conjunction with the Syrian army. That's what passes for quote unquote Russian Kremlin propaganda these days. So if you were tweeting about that, you are a quote an account known to echo Kremlin propaganda. You're not a Russian at all. So it's just, you got to follow this. You got to follow the links in these articles and really question everything, because they exaggerate and they frankly lie.
Well, that's why we look to you, Steve, for this very helpful coverage. We've got just 1 minute left. Do you want to do one more headline?
Well, okay. If we only have 1 minute, let's just do this one quickly, which bothered me. Federal judge blocks Keystone XL pipeline. This is today's headline from the Washington Post, dealing a major blow to Trump. And what I don't like about this headline is, why isn't the headline say, federal judge blocks Keystone XL pipeline in a major victory for environmentalists?
Mm-hmm.
It's not all about Trump.
This is what we were just talking about. It is all about Trump. That's what the media has decided to focus on, as opposed to, like, you know, any of the, you know, major movements and struggles going on in the country.
Seriously.
Exactly.
And then the court, the judges, they're the heroes, right? Not the people who, you know, I mean, there are massive civil disobedience actions that took place to block the Keystone XL pipeline. You know, in cities across the country, indigenous people, you know, whose land would be devastated by the pipeline, they mobilized against it. All of those people disappear, and it's just the judge heroically striking a blow against Donald Trump.
He swoops in and saves the day.
Yeah, I mean, we heard from one of those organizers earlier on the show. Yeah.
We were joined from the San Francisco Bay Area by Steve Patt. Steve is an independent journalist whose critiques of the mainstream media have been a feature of his blog, Left Eye on the News. Steve tweets at Left Eye Blog, and if you go there, you can catch up on all the headlines that we didn't have the time to get to. And we were joined here in the studio by Sputnik News analysts and producers Nicole Russell and Walter Smolarek. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking that page on Facebook, and you can follow us on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can also hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can also hear us at sputniknews.com and as a podcast at iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spreaker, and Spotify. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We'll see you next time.
Loud and Clear.